Hello, welcome back to Slightly Foxed. And with Christmas nearly upon us, we're following the footsteps of many great writers and turning to drink. Why is alcohol such an enduring feature of literature and the literary world? Did drinking help or hinder the creative process for writers such as Hemingway, Jean Rhys, and Anthony Burgess? And what about the many roles that alcohol plays in plot and characterization? So the unholy pact between the demon drink and the literary world is our subject today. And our guests, while moderate drinkers themselves, no doubt, have made a study of it. Before I introduce them, my name is Philippa Lamb, and here at the kitchen table in Hoxton Square in London sits Slightly Foxed editor Gail Perkis.
Hello.
And her fellow fox, Anna Kirk.
Hello.
And as always, in the run up to Christmas, the office is piled high with books for Christmas. It is amazing. Bells, brown paper, ribbon, the usual thing. Controlled chaos.
Controlled chaos, absolutely. But we are in the midst of packing last orders and doing the final gift wrap and gift messages. I mean, Christmas starts here early, but we're on the last leg.
By this time of the year, the whole team starts to look a bit pale and stressed.
it is sort of running on empty, I would say, at this point.
Yes, but a sense of camaraderie prevails, absolutely.
It does. So the date for last orders?
Yes, the last UK second class orders is the 17th of December, and then first class just a few days after that.
And Gail, what's flying out the door?
Well, very appropriately for this episode, our winter Slightly Foxed edition is called The Wine Lover's Daughter. And it's an enchanting memoir by Anne Faderman of her father, Clifton Faderman, who was a polymath, really, or a multi-hyphenate, as she describes him, a critic, a reviewer, a writer, a broadcaster. But in 1927, as a young man, he went to Paris to retrieve his first wife who'd run away. And while he was there, he went to the Bon Marché department store and had his very first glass of wine. And he fell in love with it. And he became a connoisseur, a collector. And she basically tells the story of his life through wine.
Well, now I am delighted to welcome our guest, novelist William Palmer, whose book In Love With Hell was published earlier this year and features drink in the lives and work of 11 writers. And Henry Jeffries, wine expert, broadcaster, author of Empire of Booze, which traces the impact of alcohol on British culture and society. Welcome to you both. Thanks so much for coming along to Hoxton Square.
Thank you. Great pleasure to be here.
William, you're chosen 11 writers. I mean, obviously, it's a huge field to choose from. They were all hard drinkers, but how did you choose them?
Well, it's very difficult because you could actually have another 11 and another 11. You could have several volumes.
Indeed.
I left out most of the Americans. I chose them because they're writers I like very much, as much as anything else.
But not just drinkers, were they? They wrote about drink.
This is the point. I mean, a lot of writers have been closet drinkers who never mention the stuff in their work. But people like Amis, an almost enormous amount of drinking goes on in his books, and there's some very good views of club and pub life, as with Burgess. Dylan Thomas, not so much, because he wrote very little prose. But he did write one very good story about himself as a young drinker in Portrait of the Artist as a Young Dog, which is about his first drinking experiences. It has been remarked to me that there aren't enough women in there, but there are lots of women alcoholic writers, but I don't think women wrote too much about pub life.
Well, women didn't go into pubs, did they?
Till the war, really. Mm. That's what broke the taboo on women on their own going into pubs.
For the record, your list of writers, it's Patrick Hamilton, Anthony Burgess, Jean Rhys, Charles Jackson, Dylan Thomas, Malcolm Lowry, Elizabeth Bishop, Richard Yates, John Cheever, Flann O'Brien, and of course, Kingsley Amis. Mm. Now, Henry, history of drinks is your area, isn't it? And location and period, it's key here, isn't it? An alcoholic writer in the 1800s would have been knocking back very different alcohol to one 50 or 100 years later.
Yeah. I suppose it depends sort of, you know, what kind of station they were in life. But most of the writers in William's book are sort of spirit drinkers, aren't they? And they'd be drinking, gin, or they'd be drinking whiskey. I mean, Amis was, you know, he used to write a drink column, but he was famously disparaging about wine. He had that sort of no-nonsense, blunt Englishman attitude to wine. I think he said that, you know, all you can say about it is that it's red and it's alcoholic. Any more than that is just, I'm paraphrasing here.
Yeah.
Any more than that is just pretentious. He was a sort of connoisseur of spirits and beer as well. He used to drink Carlsberg Special Brew, which was his favourite. He used to drink it half and half.
It's the alcoholic's favourite, isn't it?
But he had a connoisseur's approach to it. So he didn't just drink Carlsberg Special Brew. Mm. He drank Carlsberg Special Brew mixed half and half with ordinary Carlsberg.
So I'm thinking, Brits, we've got a bit of a role here, haven't we? Because we're associated with exporting the manufacture and drinking of alcohol, aren't we, throughout history? I'm dipping into your book, Empire of Booze, and there's a lot about that in there.
Yeah,
well, it's our fault, isn't it, I suppose, is what I'm saying.
No, I think so. I think they'd probably be drinking anyway. It'd just be, you know, like Malcolm Lowry was knocking back the tequila and stuff in tavernas in Mexico. So I think the British approach is quite interesting because it's the sheer variety. So even though, you know, most countries, you think of kind of Russia, you think of vodka, or you think of Scandinavia, you think of vodka and schnapps. But, you know, you don't have the sort of multiplicity of drinks. Whereas with the British approach, there was a sort of, like Amos, there was a kind of connoisseurship to getting drunk. So, you wouldn't just drink whiskey, you wouldn't just drink gin, you'd have port and sherry. And, you know, if you were a bit more upmarket, you might have claret, that sort of thing. So there was a sort of infinite variety of ways of getting drunk, and a proper kind of English or British drunk would have all these things at his or her disposal.
I know Flann O'Brien, Gail, is your personal favourite alcoholic writer. Why?
He wrote two wonderful novels as a comparatively young man, At Swim Two Birds and The Third Policeman. At Swim Two Birds was published, I think, in 1939 and only sold 240-something copies. Okay. And then the rest of the stock, I think, was destroyed in an air raid. And because the first book had not sold well, The Third Policeman was rejected and he put it in a drawer and it wasn't actually published, am I right, William, posthumously, after his death?
After he died, yes.
And after that, he became a journalist on the Irish Times, and that was his big drinking period, wasn't it?
Oh, enormous. His columns are the funniest things ever written, I think. He invented the wonderful inventions he used to invent. Something called Trink, alcoholic ink, which he recommended that the Irish Times be printed in Trink. But the trouble was, in printing it, the printers became drunk because of the fumes coming off the ink, and they had to wear gas masks. People were getting drunk reading on trains and buses.
It's a wonderful idea.
Yes.
He had an incredibly fertile imagination.
Well, he had another drink which gave you terrible feelings of nausea and headache when you were drinking it. But in the morning, you woke up in a completely radiant state of happiness.
The reverse hangover.
Yes.
Yeah. Hang-under, he called it, didn't he?
Hang-under.
Yes, yes.
See, I'm interested in this, in drink as a plot device, as well, a kind of shorthand that novelists use it as, they tell you what their person is drinking and it immediately paints a picture for you. I mean, James Bond and the martini is the obvious example, but they're shorthand, aren't they, for the reader?
Gin is a byword for despair. As soon as the word gin comes on the page,
Mother's Ruin,
you just think despair. Yeah. And it's, it's in Patrick Hamilton, but also, you know, in 1984 with the Victory Gin, it uses it to escape the misery.
Whereas port has completely different connotations.
Port has jovial connotations. Yes. You know, you think of a kind of country squire bursting out of his breeches,
a
kind of Gilroy cartoon.
Mr. Pickwick drank sherry, I should think.
Sherry's long been the most popular drink.
There is a lot of drink in Dickens. Dickens drank quite a lot himself, actually.
He was very into sherry cobblers. Yeah. He went on tour in America and was introduced to the sherry cobbler.
What is a sherry cobbler?
It's a sort of early cocktail. It's basically an iced, sweetened sherry, maybe with some fruit in. And punches as well. There's an American writer called David Wandrich who recreates some of Dickens's punches. And there are these incredibly lavish things where you have to start off by steeping your rum in pineapple for a year. So you have to start quite, before your guests arrive. and then it involves things like, a bottle of cognac, two bottles of champagne, all this kind of stuff, all put in together and then served. And that's the sort of thing Dickens was into, these incredibly lavish Victorian punches.
So it's literary messaging, isn't it? Because I was thinking about, the detective fiction of the kind of 40s and 50s in the States and in the UK, women in roadhouses, they drank gin, didn't they, or cocktails. It was a subliminal message. These were not good women. These were probably immoral women.
Yeah. That makes me think of Jean Rhys with It's Always Pernod. She's in Paris for most, she isn't, her characters are, but a lot of them were based on her own experiences in life. When she's in Paris and she's always, always ordering Pernods. Like, they're just steeped in it in
well,
Courtat and Good Morning.
She is a fascinating character. I had not understood, actually, what a huge drinker Jean Rhys was. But in terms of her work, it gave a real insight, didn't it? I mean, you see that insight in some of her characters, don't you?
We had an article in an early issue of Slightly Fox by Patricia Cleveland Peck, who had started up a correspondence with Jean Rhys after reading her books and just loving her work. And she then ended up going to visit her probably quite soon before she died. And she'd stayed over in the village and got the sense in the village that she was seen as this kind of almost like witch-like character. And they didn't quite realise that she was this, you know, once fated novelist. And she went to visit her, and there was this very, very small woman, and she'd brought her some champagne. Her daughter said, you know, we shouldn't open the champagne, but Jean persuaded them otherwise. And you know, but it left you feeling, it was quite bittersweet meeting.
It is poignant,
really,
isn't it? But she did have a late blooming, didn't she, as a literary character? Because by the time she had nearly drunk herself to death, by all accounts, it was then she produced her best known novel, wasn't it? Well, I guess the sea came late, didn't it?
Yes, it did. I think I say in the book that it's pure accident almost that she was rediscovered. And if she hadn't been rediscovered, she'd have been a sad old drunken woman who would have died.
And we would never have read any of her work.
And probably the manuscript shoved under the bed in a suitcase would have been thrown out and thrown away. But when White Sargasso Sea was published, it was such a success that all of her early novels were published.
Because she'd written, what, four before that? Yeah.
And actually, in Good Morning Midnight, she goes into a tabac and she kind of has to make up an excuse why she's there. I think she's asking for directions to a cinema or something. So it's kind of this pretense rather than just going there to get drunk, which is what she wants to do. But everybody knows that that's why she's there as well.
That is poignant. Because the other woman that springs to mind is Patricia Highsmith, isn't it? I mean, a formidable writer, but a big drinker. It's the kind of self-loathing thing, isn't it? Tom Ripley, in Talented Mr. Ripley. And the relationship.
Sort of aperitif drinking in the Ripley novels. A lot of sort of Dubonnets and Keirs and things like
that.
But he's a very light drinking character. You know, he's a sort of connoisseur. So he sort of loves his, you know, bottle of Chablis with his oysters and his the right drink at the right time.
And it kind of buoys him up, don't you feel that? You know, that little pep just to make him able to be the character that he is in the novels.
Yeah, and it's also, there's a sort of aspirational thing about it, because he's got this lifestyle he's always wanted, and then he has the drinks to go with it. So there's a lot of almost sort of James Bond-esque name-dropping of drinks in the Ripley novels, but not actually very much drunkenness, as far as I can recall.
And it's that short time we were talking about earlier, isn't it, that the drinks signify a lot about the scene for you that he then doesn't need to talk about, or she doesn't need to talk about it at length.
Yeah.
And he's also kind of got that alcoholic's kind of paranoia and kind of always being a little bit worried about how you're behaving.
Yes, that kind of silencing the internal voice of is this going as well as I think it's going? Yeah.
And how much do they know about me?
Yeah.
No, that's very clever. I hadn't thought of that.
It is
that's
such
a very interesting way of looking at it.
Fascinating character. I mean, we talked about Jean Rhys and her late career blooming, but I'm wondering whether other writers were better for drinking. I suppose I'm thinking about people like John Cheever and Raymond Carver, huge drinkers, but they both gave up in the end, didn't they?
Cheever gave up when I think he was 69 or 70. He's fascinating. But something you were saying earlier about people needing a sort of boost in the Ripley novels, a lot of these writers seem to have suffered from a sort of acute lack of self-esteem and acute horror of their own upbringings.
Yes.
And Cheever said that he always pretended he was from the Massachusetts aristocracy, Connecticut aristocracy, but he was not. There was sort of cadet branch of the Cheevers. There were rich Cheevers and there were poor Cheevers, and he was a poor Cheever, and he didn't go to university. That's another
a low achiever.
A low achiever. Very good. Dylan Thomas didn't go to university.
Social confidence.
It gives you a mask, you know.
I mean, it gives you friends and locations.
Yes.
And
the only true friends an alcoholic ever has is another alcoholic, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm right saying that Cheever and Raymond Carver bonded over the drinking initially. I mean, in a really major way. But Carver, I think he... He wrote, I mean, this great book I love, when we, what we talk about when we talk about love. I think he wrote that when he was dry, interestingly. So he went on to do some great stuff.
But do you think with writers also, I mean, you're on your own in front of a typewriter or a pad of paper or a computer and you've got to write. So resorting to the
bottle, yes.
The bottle when you're stuck.
Yeah. As a driver. Yeah, just yeah.
Well, it is.
Yeah, I think Marguerite Duras, she said that she was a real writer, but she was also a real drinker. Mm. The two things went hand in hand. And then she looked back at everything that she could drink in one day, you know, in retrospect, and just found it astonishing that she got anything done, really. But it obviously spurred her along at the time.
The danger of it is you lose sort of stage fright, which you should have as a writer, you know. Mm. Coming on the page and doing the thing properly. If you're half pissed most of the time, you don't get that. You know, you can see that in Kingsley Amis's later novels, you know, that they're rote, the, you know, R-O-T-E. They're just, he's just
more
banging,
of the same.
Banging the same stuff out all the time, you know.
Should we talk a bit about social attitudes? Because I'm also thinking, if we're thinking about Victorian literature, we talked about Dickens. I mean, I think it would be fair to say, attitudinally, you know, excessive drinking was condemned, wasn't it? Particularly, and there was a big class issue there. It was kind of fine for some people to do it, but it was the working man, absolutely not. It was a signifier of bad behaviour, loose morals, whatever it was. But these change over time, don't they? I wonder whether we're using it now as a signifier, you know, excessive drinking as a signifier of weakness rather than stylishness. It doesn't say the same thing now, does
it,
that it used to say?
I think it must seem rather old-fashioned for somebody to drink a bottle of whiskey, say, you know. It would seem dated.
Yeah, I mean, isn't it more about recreational drugs if you wanted to, you know, achieve that literary outcome?
Yes.
I don't know,
yes.
Anna, what do you think?
I'm not sure if it necessarily shows weakness in a character. I think it's probably more of like a self-destructive element or...
Yeah.
It's maybe like this, oh, well, there must be inner turmoil in their lives if they're taking to the drink, rather than a kind of celebratory.
What about
sense
the Patrick
about
Melrose
it?
Trilogy? And that's.
Yeah.
I mean, fantastic. Now, there's a man who can write about alcohol.
Very visceral.
Can we all agree on that?
Yeah.
And drugs, of course.
I don't know. Are there any successful novels about drug addicts? It's such a solipsistic thing. There's no social side to drug taking, really. Mm.
But thinking about things like Trainspotting, if you're talking about popular culture, you know, movies where, you know, drug use has been totally central to the characterisation.
Yeah, I suppose, but you've also got those kind of bad boy American writers from the 80s, you know, Bret Easton Ellis and Jay McInerney, who wrote a lot about drug use. And, you know, there is a, I've heard, a social side to drug taking, you know. You know, all that sort of, you know, going into little rooms and getting out your, you know, your thing that you've elaborately procured. You know, there's a sort of, I think Jay McInerney writes about it very well. He writes about how his friends who would have gone into raptures about getting some particularly good quality cocaine in their 20s, moving on to wine connoisseurship in their 40s and 50s.
Interesting.
Obsessing over a Viognier from Sonoma or something. And there was a whole kind of raft of methamphetamine books at one point. The Little Friend, Donna Tartt's second novel, had a lot of methamphetamine in it. Daniel Woodrell. So, you know, I think there's a lot about, but I agree, it serves a very different role. I mean, mainly because it's not so socially acceptable and there aren't public forums where you do it. It's more about going into a little world with a very tight sort of outlaw group.
Yeah, because it is the illegality is the issue here. It's not a direct parallel. It's accepting the old prohibition days, of course.
But you do have that gang feeling. Obviously, Trainspotting is the best example of it.
Yeah, because literature written at the time of prohibition must have been much the same.
Yeah, but the book that recently won the Booker, Shuggy Bain, is absolutely rock solid, cheap booze being set in Glasgow. Shuggy Bain is about alcoholism, you know. In the raw.
I've not read it.
I didn't appeal, I must say. It seemed like one of those books where I'll read about it and then go, yeah, I might give that one a miss.
I must say I didn't finish it, but I did enjoy it.
Well, that makes our point for us, doesn't it? That we're not seeing it as a positive, that it's seeming like quite an arduous subject in the way that, whereas previously, perhaps, you know, hard drinking books would be more appealing.
Well, in Amis's books, I mean, there's a lot of humour in the best of his books concerning drinking, you know, so that makes it a pleasure to read.
What about Malcolm Lowry? He was a...
Oh, God, yeah. Well, he's what I call the old word dipsomaniac. You drink anything all the time.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In Henry's book, I loved reading that because it introduced me to an awful lot of drinks I didn't know about. And he had a novel thing he'd introduced into his cocktails, which was strychnine.
Oh, my God.
In small quantities, obviously.
Yeah. It's a bit of piquancy, doesn't it? You know, a little bit of strychnine.
I can't remember the chemistry of it, but it does something quite dramatic.
They used to take it in the 60s. There's a band called the Sonics who did a song called Strychnine or Strychnine, and it's about the joys of recreational strychnine use.
don't try this at home. Yeah. It's the. I did want to ask, actually, about favourite drinking characters in books. Any in your heads?
I think the one of the funniest scenes is in Martin Chuzzlewit when Mr. Pecksniff gets completely drunk in Mrs. Todgers' lodging house and falls into the fireplace. He's one of my favourite characters because he's such an appalling hypocrite.
Oh, we haven't talked about Woodhouse, have we? I'm thinking about Bertie Wooster. He's a massive drinker, a stiffener in the morning to kind of get out of the
roaring of the butterflies, the cat stamped into the room.
Yes,
the description,
exactly.
The descriptions of the hangovers are wonderful.
And Gee spends a lot of time going and getting drinks, if I recall.
Yeah, and he has an amazing hangover remedy, which is something I think it involves.
Oh, yes.
I can't remember what it is, but obviously it's a secret recipe.
Yes.
He says it was like a bomb going off in my head.
Yeah, a stronger version of a prairie oyster of some sort. Yeah.
But so, no, Bertie Wooster's wonderful.
The Drones Club.
I mean, wow. the irony with, certainly in America, with Prohibition was that it must have had the opposite. Well, it actually drove people to strong drink, didn't it? Because it was the economics of smuggling meant it was much better to smuggle strong spirits in small quantities rather than beer or wine.
Well, it destroyed the American brewing industry and the wine industry as well. Mm. So it was sort of, it's why America until very recently was a bit of a wasteland for good beer and good wine, because it had all been wiped out by Prohibition and people just turned to spirits. And if you read, you know, all the people that are here in your book, they're all, I don't know, sometimes when you read American literature of the sort of 30s, 40s, 50s and see the films, it's like the whole country is going on a spirit binge.
Mm.
And they're just celebrating that they can get hold of it legally and in, you know, big quantities.
You're right, because it was the young, it was another rebellious cause they could join in, drinking forbidden liquids.
And it was socially acceptable for women. I mean, going back sort of before Prohibition, cocktail bars were places where it was socially acceptable for women to drink, and there were drinks that were aimed for women to drink.
Specifically
women. So you could drink very, very strong alcohol easily. That's basically what cocktails are designed for. So you have like a bit of vermouth or a bit of sugar or a bit of fruit juice to help your 50% gin go down. You know, they're very frightening things, cocktails, because
They
are. It's more like drug taking, I think, than sipping your wine or drinking your pints of beer.
Is that why the martini is so kind of totemic amongst writers?
Because
exactly it's just
it.
Really, really alcoholic.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's just a way of drinking, you know, and they drink it so it's just frozen. If you go to Duke's Bar, where their martinis are huge, and he just puts a bit of vermouth in, shakes it on the floor, then pours frozen gin in, hands it to you.
And that's basically it. And I've been rereading John Cheever's short stories recently, and the omnipresence of cocktail drinking.
Yeah.
I mean, it's everywhere. And he does do it so beautifully as signifiers of mood and circumstance, and it's really elegantly done. I mean, it's everything we've been talking about is in those short stories, don't you think?
Oh, I think so. I mean, his work is saturated in gin. It gives off a sort of light in his work, you know, which is something you find when you drink a lot when you're young, is the pleasure of waking up in the morning with it still in your system, which non-drinkers will never experience.
And he talks about that, doesn't he?
And that's a wonderful piece of youth, that is.
But it's that kind of synthetic glow in his work, that the drinking casts of everything, and it all looks fine.
Mm.
And you know that underneath it, there's terrible misery going on, and it is beautifully expressed, and that they would just not be the same books without all that alcohol.
Well, I wanted to ask you a question, William, from the book. I love the book, and I just... Bit of a broad question, but do you think these writers, or some of these writers, how would they have been without the drink? So would Amis have been as good? Would Cheever have been as good? Or would they have been even better? Would they have been even more productive?
Well, they would not have been the writers they are, but they might have been Thomas Hardy or Tolstoy. I mean, Tolstoy became a teetotaler, but he was a heavily drinking young man, I suspect they would have been writers or some form of artist. I sometimes think that Amis would have been a sort of music hall comedian, you know. In fact, with Philip Larkin, you know, because they were both very funny.
Like a Morecambe and Wise.
Exactly. Well, I mean, he does look a bit like Eric Morecambe Larkin, doesn't he?
Yes.
I was just thinking that, yeah.
I don't know what sort of writers they'd have been. It's a question you can't answer, because the reason these people perhaps wrote at all is because their psychology demanded two things, the drink and the sort of, I don't know, the upset it makes in your psychology, you know, the different forms of changing mood and changing your perception of the world.
See, this is the thing. I think we're only really talking about successful writers, aren't we? Because you can't be an alcoholic writer and hold down a day job. So you have to make enough money out of your writing to be able to be at home to be an alcoholic writer. Do you see what I mean?
I held down quite a lot of jobs.
so much for that idea.
When I started working, the long lunch was quite common.
Long lunches with authors were one of the very few perks of the job.
That's what I'm saying.
I've just been reading Jeremy Lewis's, or rereading his book, Kindred Spirits, and there's some wonderful lunches in that. All the descriptions of him just reeling around Fitzrovia, having been at L'Etoile or somewhere like that after.
Well, I think that brings us nicely to a close. Yeah, I really do. And I've noticed that Gail actually does have a bottle about her person, so I might just send her off to...
I do indeed. I went off to the local off-licence, and because it's nearly Christmas, we're all going to have a glass of sherry and some salted almonds.
It's a very slightly Fox drinking choice. I mean, talking about signifiers.
Did you bring any olives?
No, I'm afraid not.
Slightly Foxed is a publishing house based in East London. It was founded by two editors, Gail Perkis and Hazel Wood. The team began publishing a quarterly magazine about all those great books on publishers' backlists that can be so hard to find in bookshops. They also reissue out-of-print books they think deserve a new generation of readers. Everything they publish is beautifully produced, from their pocket-sized cloth-bound hardbacks to illustrated collectible editions for children. Posted out to subscribers in 80 countries, the magazine itself is a collection of readable and entertaining articles about all sorts of books, fiction and non-fiction. The contributors are equally varied. Some are distinguished writers, journalists or academics, while others come from very different walks of life. Now, after 17 years, the Fox team still love finding new readers, so the annual subscription to the magazine is very reasonably priced. Even better, your subscription gives you free access to the searchable digital archive. Sign up for an annual subscription at foxquarterly.com, or if you'd rather speak to a person, give the London office a call on 020 7033 0258. Thank you.
Anna, we've got a Christmas special on the Literary Day Out, haven't we?
Yes, we have. I've been in touch with our friends at London Literary Tours, who provide walking tours with performance of excerpts from novels, plays, poems, letters, interspersed with stories about the lives of writers. So I spoke to Cindy and Mike, who run London Literary Tours. So this is a swift wet-your-whistle-stop tour through the drinking dens of London.
Of which there are many.
So, okay, brace up. Some, of course, are closed and gone forever, like the Crown in Charing Cross Road of the late Victorian era, where the likes of Oscar Wilde and Ernest Dowson went, the latter who famously urged us to seize the day. They are not long the days of wine and roses, which is a good sentiment. But let's start by going back in time to Southwark. So there's the George Inn in Borough High Street, which is leased by the National Trust.
Beautiful building.
It's very beautiful. Would definitely recommend checking it out. But the Tabard once stood next to it, and it was from here that the pilgrims set out in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales.
Of course.
But that now, sadly, is no longer there. It was demolished. But Dickens frequented the George, referenced it in both Our Mutual Friend and Little Dorrit. But for a place with plenty of Dickens references, we cross the river over to Bank, to the George and Vulture, which Dickens spent many hours there, and he also mentions that in the Pickwick Papers. But from there, we then go over to Fleet Street, ye olde Cheshire Cheese.
Many drinking holes there.
Yes, absolutely. ye olde Cheshire Cheese also appears in Tales of Two Cities, but also was frequented by loads of other writers, Mark Twain, Wilkie Collins, Thackeray, Chesterton, Samuel Johnson. And it also pops up in The Dynamiter by Robert Louis Stevenson, as well as stories by Trollope, Woodhouse. And Pepys actually wrote about it in his diaries. Oh, sorry, no, that's Ye Olde Cock Tavern, which is also Grade II listed. And Oliver Goldsmith, who often shared an ale with Dr. Johnson there, loved it so much that he was buried behind the cock at Temple Church, and apparently his ghost returns on occasion to scare off punters.
So they say.
So they say. But yes, let's go to Soho, the French house, perhaps Soho's best known pub, haunt of lots of hard drinking writers, particularly Dylan Thomas. It was said that actually he left behind his finished manuscript of Under Milkwood after getting very drunk there, but fortunately it was saved. Then very close by, we can go to the Wheat Sheaf in Fitzrovia, and that's where Dylan Thomas met his wife, Catelyn McNamara. It also attracted lots of other artists and writers in the 1930s and 40s, as well as the Fitzroy Tavern and the Marquis of Granby, very close by. But from Fitzrovia, we head to St. James's, where we go to Duke's Hotel, where you might drink a Vesper cocktail, which was created by a former barman there with input from, of course, Ian Fleming, the shaken, not stirred martini. Then there's also the Cavendish Hotel, which was made famous by Rosa Lewis. She was the proprietor there and known as the Duchess of Jermyn Street. Both her and the hotel were satirised in Evelyn Waugh's Vile Bodies, and apparently Rosa never forgave Waugh. And then finally, we just hop over to the Golden Lion next to St. James's Theatre, where Oscar Wilde was among the drinkers.
He's popped up several times, hasn't he?
He does get about a bit, yes. And this was probably very handy for him by being by the theatre. So, of course, the importance of being Ernest among other performed there, so he could pop in. And then finally, the Café Royal in Regent Street. Again, Oscar Wilde drinking a great deal of absinthe there. And that probably will do.
I think if you did all of them one go, it definitely would do.
That would be quite a pub crawl.
as Mike says at the London Literary Tours, if you're still standing at this point, very well done.
Well, yeah, and I can see William Henry nodding along to all those venues. Do you know all of them?
The lower end of them, I do know quite well over the years.
So I'm going to have to ask you for your own personal favourite literary drinking holes.
The Oxford Bar in the new town of Edinburgh, indeed, which is a wonderful old pub, very kind of unfancy, and it's where Ian Rankin's Detective Rebus used to drink, and it feels like it hasn't changed in 40 years. It's a wonderful old pub.
Yeah, that's a great recommendation. Well, I think moving swiftly on from that, I'm going to ask you for book recommendations, actually, and I'm going to start with Gail, because she seems at this stage to be sober.
Just about. I would like to recommend a series called What to Look For. They're the Ladybird books, What to Look For in Spring, Summer, Autumn and Winter. They were originally, I think the first series was published in 1959. Generations of boys and girls grew up learning about the countryside from these books. The Ladybird books themselves started in 1915 with the discovery that with a piece of paper called a quad crown, you could fold it into 56 pages. So it was a very economical format. And that's how the Ladybird books started. Anyhow, the What to Look For series in the late 50s was illustrated by Charles Tunnicliffe, wonderful wood engraver and artist whose work we featured in Slightly Fox quite a lot. And they were in print for many, many years. Ladybird have now reissued the series with new illustrations by Natasha Durley, and they've changed the content really to reflect the changes that have happened in the countryside. So the first series, there was quite a lot of emphasis on collecting things, which obviously one wouldn't want to do now. There was much less on environment. The pictures in them were idealised portraits of, for example, a hedgerow with an improbable number of birds in it, which you would never actually see.
Yeah.
But the new series, I'm about to give my grandson the winter one. I've been giving him one a season year. There's one on dark evenings and why they're dark and how that affects animal and bird life. Tracks in the snow, what you would see in an estuary, quite a lot on invertebrates and, you know, insects. They're charming, and they're, you know, for a 6 to 10 year old, he's loving them. On his walks to school, he's noticing things. They're $5.99 each. Perfect stocking filler.
Yeah, great suggestion.
I recommend them.
William.
Well, just a word about that. My daughter, who's now 42, had those when she was young.
Mm.
They're lovely, yeah.
Yes.
Books, yeah. Book recommendation is one I wrote about in Slightly Foxed, which is by Kingsley Amis, The Green Man. The title comes from the name of a pub, so that's my literary pub as well. So it's one of the few modern ghost stories that actually works, and it's very in the tradition of M.R. James, in so far as people look at old documents and ghosts arise from the past. And basically it's the story of the landlord of the pub, who is a bottle-a-day man. That's not beer, that's whiskey.
Okay.
Whose father dies, and the pub is haunted by the Green Man, which is a ghastly apparition from outside. But he manages it very well, because ghost stories work best in gaslit times, don't they, in modern life.
Yeah, tricky.
They don't work so well, unless they're horror stories, which is a different genre altogether. It's a marvellous picture of running a pub, for one thing, and the perils of adultery and general misbehaviour. I mean, the landlord of the pub is very, very Kingsley Amis, isn't it?
Right.
But it is a finely written book. It's also the only appearance in a book I've read, apart from the Bible and Paradise Lost, where God appears as a character. I think it's God. It may be death, but it's a bit ambiguous. But that is my favourite book about pubs.
Yeah, that really does sound very good. And yes, sounds very seasonal, actually.
So, well, yeah, for Christmas, it's ideal. I first read it in a pub called The Green Man, so I thought that was very good.
Henry.
I've got another drink-based book, I'm afraid. The Wet and the Dry by Lawrence Osborne. It's a travel book. Lawrence Osborne is a novelist. It's a very interesting life. He sort of kicked about all over the world and only really had any success in the last 10 years or so. And he kind of combines writing novels with writing about drink for various American publications. And The Wet and the Dry is about drinking in the Islamic world. And it's a travel book. And he goes through various countries and basically tries to get drunk. And it's quite easy in Beirut. He goes out to Beirut and he visits the vineyards in the Bekaa Valley and writes so beautifully about the country. And then he goes to Dubai, Karachi. There's a single malt distillery in Pakistan that makes very, very good whiskey. And it's only for sale. They're not allowed to export to the country's Hindus and Christians, who have a pass which says how much they're allowed to drink, which they have stamped when they buy alcohol. So the Hindus,
really?
And Christians and Sikhs are rationed but how much they can drink. So this is the kind of amazing things you discover.
Fascinating.
And he goes
yeah.
to Saudi Arabia, so all Indonesia, Malaysia, all over the Islamic world, and investigates their drinking cultures. And basically, he's a self-confessed heavy drinker, and he gets drunk in every one of these countries. He writes beautifully. He's very funny. He gets into scrapes, as you can imagine. But he has a sort of an insight. So I would say it's one of the best travel books I've read. So highly recommended.
And that's The Wet and the Dry.
The Wet and the Dry.
And the writer again?
Lawrence Osborne.
When was that published?
I think it was 2013.
Yeah, so fairly recent.
Yeah, it was definitely
recent.
In the last 5 or 10 years.
Yeah. Anna?
I'm actually also going to recommend a book that is about drink, but I have just very recently read it. It's called Happy Hour, and it's by Marlo Granados, and it was just published by Verso Books. And it essentially recounts a summer in New York in 2013 and is very modern in feel, but it also very much reminded me of things like, well, the main character's a bit like Holly Golightly,
okay,
or the heroines of Anita Loos, that kind of...
Yeah.
They're surviving on their wiles alone. They're completely broke. They have no money. They are kind of trying to... They're always blagging drinks. They've a very glamorous life in the evenings.
Front. Yeah, desperate so behind.
They never pick up the bill. It's always... Yeah. It's we were talking about books being steeped in drink, and I think the drink in this one is probably martini, is the one that is constantly coming up. So yes, it follows this 20-year-old girl called Issa, and they're just... set on like the pursuit of pleasure, essentially, but using all the time, their wits really, rather than any. They do have talent, but they're selling clothes at markets during the day, and then they're kind of going to the Hamptons or they're going to the Upper East Side from Brooklyn in the evenings. And it's very wild. It's quite intoxicating in how it's written. It's very sensory. There's lots about bright lights and lots of tastes and smells, and it almost felt quite exhausting actually by the end of it, but it's very evocative of a particular time and a particular city. I'd recommend it as a quick, kind of exciting read.
And in that long tradition of attractive young women living on their wits, through from Becky Sharp to others to now.
Yeah. And this was just published in 2021 and still the same themes.
Excellent. That is all for this month and for 2021. William, Henry, thank you so much for being with us.
No, thank you for inviting me.
Thank you very much.
Very interesting.
Many thanks to all of you two for being with us this year. We've had a lot of fun exploring forgotten books, from obscure Golden Age crime novels to the extraordinary Sybil Bedford, newly discovered work by Ted Hughes, graphic novels in the 1940s, all fascinating, all available for you to catch up on over the holiday in those moments when Christmas becomes a touch too much. You'll find the whole back catalogue of nearly 40 episodes on any podcast app, obviously, or indeed the Slightly Fox website, foxquarterly.com, where you will also find a wonderful cache of books and other good things for those last-minute festive gifts.
Yes, and we'll be back next year on January the 15th. And in the meantime, from all of us at Slightly Fox, we'd like to wish you a very happy Christmas and a peaceful New Year.